Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment in our region as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Later in the program, I'll be speaking with Rusty Anderson. He's been Paul McCartney's guitarist since 2001, though he's been fronting his own bands for years. The latest band is the Rusty Anderson Afternoon. First, though, Riverside Community Players presents The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, opening May 25th. More at riversidecommunityplayers.com. I spoke with Sean Warner, playing the role of Ransom Foster, and director Mia Mercado.
Thank you, David. Nice to be here.
Absolutely. Now, let's start, please, with the where's and when's for The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Okay, we are playing at Riverside Community Players, and that's at 4026 14th Street in beautiful Riverside. We open our play May 25th and run through June 10th.
Wonderful. Okay, and a website or a phone number or both for reservations, more information?
RiversideCommunityPlayers.com, 951-686-4030.
Okay, we've had Mia Mercado on a few times. We may finally get the punch card thing going where, you know, eventually you'll get the Public Radio Nerd shirt if you get 10 punches or something like that.
But, well, I'm halfway there.
That's right. Sean, how about a bit of your theater background?
Well, actually, I'm new to theater. Okay. I only started 4 years ago, and my first play, a friend of mine, I was in an improv troupe, and she had done a lot of work doing theater, and she asked me, she's like, I don't know if you do this, but you'd be perfect for this part. And I was like, well, it's Tuesday, I got nothing to do, so I'll give it a go. I went down there, and it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed the process of it, and it was a little scary at first, but I love the fear of it. I love the fear of standing in front of other people and having to perform. And they gave me the part, and I was elated. Like, I just couldn't believe it. And that whole process, the show was amazing. I made good friends from it, and I couldn't ask for a better experience. And once that bug bit me, that was it.
Oh, yeah.
That was it.
Cool. Well, and then, Mia, let's talk storyline for a moment. We've already discussed the fact that the movie would not really serve as a good example for what you might get at the play. But is it similar in that, in essence, funeral, flashback, and then back to present day?
Yeah, it's set up the same way in that regard. They are both based off the short stories by Dorothy M. Johnson.
Okay.
And the man who wrote this play, Jethro Compton, actually is a Brit that was dreaming of the Old West. So the storyline is based off of these short stories. But there are some character differences in the play. Of course, the cast is much more scaled down. There are fewer roles. But I feel like they're much more well-written in the play, and you really get to see the depth of these characters.
Well, let's get a better description of the storyline than what I had said with simply a funeral, flashback, present day. How does the storyline go in the play version of this?
Well, it does start with a flashback at a funeral, and we get a little glimpse into the storyline, and then it goes back in time, and we get to see the setup of these characters in the saloon. It's really a story of love and pride and sacrifice in the Wild West, and these characters are very bold and have strong convictions, and they're not afraid to speak their mind and live their lives at a pace of a bullet, as the author says.
Nice way of saying that. I wish that was you, don't you? I know you're reading somebody else. You're quoting somebody else. Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, no, I mean, these were strong characters. John Wayne was one of the guys in the movies, and just and Lee Marvin. So both the play and the movie, both of these were based on the short story.
Yeah, it's a story by Dorothy M. Johnson. And the author for this play is Jethro Compton.
Now, this is going to be dancing delicately around this, I think, without giving away too much of the plot. But some people will certainly have seen the movie. So how about some of the differences? And of course, saying what something is should be easier done than just saying what it's not. But this is one that folks may know. What are some things, if folks have seen the movie and they're expecting to go in and see this?
It's a wonderful story. Having not even seen the movie, the title right there explains it, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. So it starts out with this funeral, and then you get the flashback. And you get all these wonderful characters that come in, and it's a story of love, a story of hope. And I don't think it matters really, truly, if you know the ending, like if you knew the movie and know what happens. I think what is important, and what Mia has done an incredible job already, is creating relationship. And I think that's far more interesting and far more important than plot, which the plot is good. And even if you know, like, what she's doing subtly, just making these people and care about each other, and you as the audience actually care about that. And I think that's what makes it amazing. So I don't think it will make a difference. I think you will enjoy this play, whether you've seen the movie or not.
Cool, certainly.
I do think the audiences will be fulfilled in their expectation. There are cowboys. There is a love story. Mm-hmm. It is very similar to the movie in that way. And, of course, there is a duel.
Okay, there is. We do have a showdown on stage.
We do have a showdown on stage.
Oh,
okay. I'm excited. I can't get it. I can't wait.
No kidding.
And it's intense. These actors are working very, very hard. Opposite Sean Warner in that scene is Pete Bennett, who plays Liberty Valance, and he is incredibly intense on stage. Balancing it out, you also have Burt Barracoon, that's played by Aaron Neota. He is a slow burn. He's kind of got that layer of dust and rust on his character, and Aaron is playing that beautifully. Hallie in the movie is not as well developed as you would have maybe liked her to be. So I think audiences will enjoy the difference in this play, that these characters are more developed. You get to see many facets of Hallie. She's a strong, excuse my French, hell of a gal. And I think audiences will really enjoy seeing her develop on stage. And she's played by Tiffany Champagne.
Let's just go ahead and talk about the other actors for a moment. Who else we have in there? This is an 8-person play?
Yeah, it's written for 6 main characters, and then there are several extra roles, and I've cast 3 fellows who will be playing those 3 ensemble parts. They'll be playing multiple roles. Someone else I really want to mention is Ron Blakely, who plays the role of Jim. Jim is a young black swamper, and he's kind and enthusiastic, and audiences will really fall in love with his character. He's wonderful.
These guys playing the multiple roles, this is going to be a bit of The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance in the area of Greater Tuna, Texas?
Not quite that extreme. And with much less humor, unfortunately. Yeah. Or fortunately. This is a very dramatic play. There is some humor in the writing, but it's a pretty serious piece, and I'm glad to tackle it. It's a little bit out of my wheelhouse. I normally work on musicals, musical theater, farce, comedy. But to do something that's very gritty and very heavy, I'm really enjoying this challenge.
You know what? This leads right into this nicely. I wanted to ask first Mia and then Sean so you can prepare for this. But Mia, I wanted to know what this play is for you. And you may have just answered that to a certain extent, in that with your reputation and ability, you could be doing any type of theater in the region, okay? So why this Western, this thing of intensity, this non-musical?
Well, I have to give a bunch of credit to my dad, because I sat and watched a lot of Westerns, probably bored in those days, but watched a lot of Westerns when I was young. So this is kind of a tribute to my dad. He's not a real big fan of Grease and some of the other musicals that I've been involved in, you know. This is right up his alley. And I think as an artist, you need to push yourself. You shouldn't just get stuck in a rut and do the same kind of shows. Especially as a director, I want to stretch my wings and do things that I have never done before and take on new challenges and expand what I can give back to the audience. I think it'll make me a more well-rounded director and performer when I go forward into my next role, whatever that may be. It's really a personal challenge that I've enjoyed. In fact, when the shows are released for the year, the theaters will send a list to all potential directors, and you have a list of about 6 different shows that you can choose from.
Ah.
And I put in for this show first as my number one pick. And I'm so pleased that the board of directors of Riverside Community Players decided to give it to a girl and let somebody else give it a try. I think it was a good risk for everyone.
Wonderful. So, Sean, same for you. You know, I'm not sure of your entire repertoire, but tell me about this. What is this play for you? The type of role that you're going after? What is this?
Well, it's interesting. The first and foremost is I wanted to work with Mia.
Oh, thank
I've
you.
I've seen her stuff. I never had to see her work, but actually being a part of that, it's been amazing. So I'm excited about that. Theater in general for me is, it's almost therapy. It's cathartic, especially with everything that I'm going through right now. Rance Foster in this play left New York and he's going west to find his purpose. That kind of parallels with Sean Warner, who is on a new path. I used to be a business owner for 16 years and now I am trying to find my purpose. And this 3 years is, it's been dark, it's been tough. But when I get on stage and I get to dip into the words, I forget all that. You know, life melts away and I can just enjoy playing with my fellow actors and everything is at peace for me. And I love that part of it. So that's why I'm excited about this. And that's why I'm working my tail off at home. Like every day I've turned my living room into a saloon so that I can really
give my best. You
drink a lot. Of course.
Okay. I'm speaking with Mia Mercado and Sean Warner, the man who shot Liberty Valance, opens May 25th. More at riversidecommunityplayers.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org, I'm David Fleming. Sean, back to you. This is a role that, gosh, it would require some intensity as well as some much softer moments. And so tell me again, and I don't know what kind of background you've had as far as just training or experience, so all that really aside, I don't really care. But in getting ready for rehearsal or for performance when you get there, finding that character, what are some of the things that you end up putting yourself through?
Well, music is one big thing for me. I try to find music that relates to my character, and then I'll play that on a loop constantly because I think music is moving. Music is part of getting into a mood, which is really important.
What's the music for this then?
Well, I started with Bon Jovi's Dead or Alive.
Three chords, real trouble.
Sure. that voice, Jovi. But yeah, it's funny because this character is stubborn and he's arrogant and I'm not those things, so okay. Trying to, and I have children, so I got to be gentle when I'm at home, especially because it's easy to fall into that and be careful what you do with the people around you. So yeah, it's interesting trying to find a soft spot because I do believe this story and his character arc, he does come in arrogant, but I think he leaves a better person in the end for sure. And I'm still researching. We're only a week in. The play's really starting to get its legs. And I'm excited to just really, once we get the book out of our hand and the words are in our head, then it's really going to flourish.
I have to say, these guys are so good that I'm working with. They really have brought their A game. And not to diminish any of the other shows that I've worked on before, but I feel like we're just ahead of the game. They're just all naturals. Mm. They come in ready. They come in prepared. They come in with intent, not just having memorized words. And some of the words are not easy. There are passages in this script that are Shakespeare and sonnets. And so they're having to learn a lot of different things and they're coming ready. These actors are so good. Last night at rehearsal, I was getting chills. I almost cried two different times. It was really intense and really beautiful to watch and really encouraging that we're just at the jumping off point. We still have a few more weeks to go and I can't wait till the show opens. It's going to send people right out of their seats.
What kind of stage is this? Is this a three-quarter thrust, a proscenium? Tell me this isn't round.
This is an arena stage.
Okay.
It is an arena stage, and it's quite intimate. So you have actors that are literally standing next to a rail, and the rail on the other side is at the knees of the patron. So you're within inches of the actors, and so when those intense moments happen, you are right there in the room with them, and it can be quite incredible.
Some of the most rewarding times I've had with some of my most intense characters have been in those intimate settings where you can get right up there and not only scare your fellow actors, but the patrons as well. That is...
Yeah, it's nice to hear the gasp from the crowd, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And it feeds the actors' energy quite a bit.
Oh, certainly, certainly. Same whether it's Cole Porter or this.
That's right.
It works. Well, so Mia, tell me about the rehearsal process, and I know you're just barely into it, but as far as getting your actors to find these right levels, to bring them up or down, whatever the case may be for the various characters.
Yeah, so we start with just logistics, and the way that I work is I work very quickly, and I like to just lay some groundwork and do some basics of you enter here, you sit there. But I'm allowing these actors in particular to find their own paths because they are so natural, and I want this show to feel very natural. I don't want anyone to ever seem like they're acting or they're playing. Mm. This isn't a show that's played for laughs. You know, it has to be played very, very genuine and real. So we start with just the basics of walking the stage, figuring out where we need to be for certain things to happen. In this show, there are an incredible amount of shots taken. So we're always wondering, where is the whiskey bottle at this point? And then once we start getting into the scene work, then I will stop and ask the actors why they're doing something. What do you think this means? Or, for example, hey, I think you've got the wrong inflection on this line. I think it means this. And then all of a sudden, the actor's light bulb goes off and says, oh, yeah, that makes a lot more sense. So then once we get further into that, then we have to layer on a lot of technical aspects as well. You know, acting is not just coming in and saying some dialogue with meaning. You also have a lot of props in this show. You're going to have costumes that are cumbersome. We have a lot of weapons in this show that people will need to get used to. So week by week, I try and layer in another level to this process. And really and truly, community theaters have the toughest job because most of our shows are put up within 6 weeks. Professional theater, they have months and months to get it right. And so we've really got to get in there and work very quickly and very dedicated.
It's actually, I find, incredibly more intense sometimes, the community theater level of theater experience, than other levels.
That's right. And we definitely do it for the love of it.
We did talk about what this play is for you, and that is, you know, why you're doing this particular role. But Sean and Mia, talk for a second, each of you, about what you're really getting out of this. What are you finding now? I suppose when we spoke about this with a similar question earlier, I guess we were talking about what brought you to the play. But now that you're into it a bit, what are some of the things that you're finding, some rewarding aspects or maybe some challenges?
For me, because I'm so new at it, I'm finding that every play I've done, I've learned something about myself. Always. Right. And this one will be no different, I'm sure, already. For me, I struggle with being a perfectionist. I struggle with, am I doing that right? And instead of, I need to believe in myself, I need to believe in what it is I'm doing. And to Mia's credit, if she gave me the role, which makes her a genius. no, I'm just kidding. But believe it. That's a struggle for me, is trying to find that balance of, okay, stop beating yourself up. Stop being so critical and just go and do the work at the best of your ability and it will come out. And especially with the help of Mia and my fellow actors, I get enjoyment out of it. I get happiness out of it. It's so
good.
Yeah.
Nice.
I would have to agree with what you were saying earlier. It's very cathartic. It takes you away from your regular life and refocuses, redirects your attention for a while. So that's a very therapeutic part of doing theater. With this story in particular, I was very moved from the first moment that I read this play.
Really?
I read it and immediately went back to the first page and read it again. I don't know that I've ever read a play twice in a row back to back. I was moved to tears. I was gasping. I was on the edge of my seat with suspense. So to now be seeing this come to life and to have these amazingly beautiful humans that are telling this story, it really is a love story, a story of honor, a story of loyalty, a story of strength of character. You also see some sadness and some life lessons in here. There are issues with race in this show. It's a very strong piece that I think everyone could take something away from. And that means a lot to me. So many of the times when I'm doing a farce, it's very fun and it's very funny and we run all over like crazy maniacs. But really, is there a lot of heart to it? Sometimes if it's well written. This show has an incredible amount of heart. So for me, that's very fulfilling.
This one has to be somebody in a fluffy piece, another play. You can afford not to get too deep into it, but not so with this.
Right. And again, I've told the actors, I don't want you to pretend or play or, you know, work towards the audience. This is all about you. And I want you to connect with each other and have eye contact across the stage and really feel the emotions of the story that you're telling. And on the flip side of that coin, in just a short few rehearsals, as I said, I'm already getting chills. These actors are really bringing it to the stage this time. This is what that play will be like for this audience.
Nice. Well, gosh, Mia, I was going to kind of wrap by having each of you give us one thing that would just draw people in and get them to the theater, but you just gave us a couple of great things right there. So let's talk about the score for the play. This is cool.
Yes. So Fox and the Red Hairs, a local Riverside band, has agreed to let me use their music for the show, and they're rearranging some of their songs for the show. They're super excited to be part of this project. It's something out of their realm as a local Americana roots rock band. And because of your recommendation, David, thank you very much. I took a listen to their music and immediately knew that they had the sound that I was looking for this play. I will need music for scene changes. I will need music before the show at intermission. But I've always put a lot of thought into the music that goes to any production that I'm part of.
Uh-huh.
And with a straight play, this lends opportunity to set a mood before a scene or carry you out of a scene. And I'm really very excited to have Fox and the Red Hairs part of that. And I know that they're very excited as well.
That is really incredible. I knew that you had connected with them, and I thought that they were doing some songs to help out. They're actually scoring.
They are. They're doing a cover of Wayfaring Stranger for me.
Nice.
And they're also taking some of their songs that they have already recorded, and they're restructuring or re-recording them for us. In fact, they were so excited. They went out and they bought the script and read through the script and want to come to rehearsals to be involved. And so I'm very pleased that they'll be joining us. It is nice to have a local Riverside connection to the theater with a local Riverside band.
That's right. Wonderful. Mia Mercado and Sean Warner. Sean playing Ransom Foster and Mia Mercado directing. This is the man who shot Liberty Valance. So Mia, one more time before we close, the dates, the where's, the when's, and of course the website for more information and tickets.
The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance is running May 25th through June 10th at the Riverside Community Players. Tickets are $16 each. You may log on to riversidecommunityplayers.com or call 951-686-4030.
Fantastic. Mia Mercado and Sean Warner, thank you so much. This is something to look forward to here.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org, I'm David Fleming. Let's go now to music and conversation from Rusty Anderson. He's been Paul McCartney's guitarist since 2001, though he's been fronting his own bands for years. I spoke with Rusty shortly before being able to hear his latest disc in its entirety, with some tracks playing over and over, like The Sound of Music, seven tracks in. The Sound of Music, off the latest disc from the Rusty Anderson Afternoon, simply called RAA. Rusty's been a part of or fronting bands since he was in his early teens, and this latest, I really wanted to know about the name. I told him the Rusty Anderson Afternoon sounded like an event, or playing the guitar on his front porch.
Well, yeah, it sort of was a weird way that it came about. It was a contest on the website that people vote on names, and that's the one that ended up floating. And it has sort of a nice, innocuous kind of vibe, you know, that was sort of open for interpretation, which the band is rather eclectic, so it seemed to fit it.
The record always skips in a cool way. Sunken treasure ships lost in a cool way. Electric fingertips. Shake your hips in a cool way.
We're going to be touching on several bands a little bit later, so when did this come together?
Well, let's see, I guess it was about 2013, maybe. Well, we did an event, a sort of combo thing. I did a signature Gibson guitar that came out.
Oh, cool.
And that was sort of the release for that, along with a charity event for the National Resource Defense Council, which I'm a big proponent of. So that was sort of the first gig we did as the Rusty Anderson Afternoon.
Okay, cool.
Church I used to go to.
Now, Evidence. This was a single released early for this album?
I think it all came out at the same time, but yeah, that was sort of the first single, and it's sort of weird the way it happens, because people just sort of pick up on different songs, you know?
Right.
On Sirius Radio, they started playing Danny the Doubler, and then before that, on the last record, we had a lot of action with the song called Effortless. That was actually the previous record. That one was sort of an interesting collage of 16th century poetry and modern. It was a strange way that that song came about, but there's no real way that we sort of write. It's all sort of different options, and I like the creativity of that, because I spend so much time, you know, touring and playing with Paul McCartney on the road, and then this is nice to come home and get into recording and playing some shows and stuff, and it's a nice balance, you know?
Yeah.
Keeps the, all the creativity flowing.
You mentioned that writing is different every time. Evidence has this really good drive and just as much of a percussive element in the guitar chords as the drum kit itself.
Mm-hmm.
So how did this one come together? Was it a riff that some vocals came in on top of, or did somebody write it out and then you looked for the riff to go with it?
Well, Todd and I were messing about, and I think I came up with the chorus melody.
Mm.
And then we just needed something to go with it. And it was originally much kind of slower. And then we sped it up a bit. And then sort of writing lyrics to it. And yeah, that one had its own unique evolution, as I guess as they all do.
Sure.
But yeah, I kind of wanted the simplicity of the guitar thing just to be a driving, almost Talking Heads kind of deal.
Yeah, nice.
She's 6 years old. And at the time, I was listening to a lot of Elvis Radio and getting into that, where they go, yeah, this week on Elvis, they say it's Elvis Radio, and it's Elvis Week on Elvis Radio. And I thought, well, isn't it always Elvis Week on Elvis Radio?
Yeah.
But so I got into that vibe, and so it sort of has that sort of coloration to it.
Didn't you play with Lisa Marie at some point, or cover some
right,
of the music?
I did. I've done a lot of different recordings over the years with different artists, and Lisa Marie was one of them. Yes, we worked over Capitol Records and did maybe about 5 or 6 tunes.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
Now, one other name that I just want to know about and how it happened. There's a listing of a lot of the folks that you've played with. Steve Lukather, that's the name that I seized on. How did you end up playing with him? Was this some event somewhere? Are you on one of his albums? Is he on one of yours?
Steve Lukather. I think we just, I mean, I know him. He's a terrific guy. And I guess we sort of jammed together. You know what it was? There was this big 50th anniversary Ed Sullivan sort of commemoration or something. And it was Paul and Ringo. And then a host of other people playing too, like including, you know, some of the people from Ringo's band. And Peter Frampton was there, and Jeff Lynne, and Dave Grohl. And, you know, it was sort of the star-studded evening of all these people.
Gotcha.
Maybe that's what it's referring to.
Okay, that's what it was then. Okay. So I haven't been able to go through all of your albums. So most of what I find is electric, right? So I mean, this is mostly what you'll be doing.
Yeah, it's sort of, we try to kind of keep a variety. I mean, I sort of subscribe to the more 60s mentality of like, you know, you go to Woodstock and there'd be all these different bands, you know, from like, you know, The Who and Richie Havens and whoever, you know, Jimi Hendrix and Melanie. And it's the variety, I think, is sort of that mentality of music as opposed to the niche marketing of today where you get a record and everything sounds the same. Ours is a little more eclectic. So, yeah, it'll be some acoustic bits and some electric bits and, you know, everything in between, really.
Okay, good. That's Rusty Anderson. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Online at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. I started off with more of the electric side of Rusty Anderson. As a matter of fact, I was actually vaguely aware of the Living Daylights. Somewhere in Kentucky is where I grew up. I came across the Living Daylights somehow, some point. Let's go back to, even before that, if you don't mind, briefly anyway. A few bands in this area, Inland Empire, L.A.-based, would remember Eulogy, I would imagine.
Right. Well, I grew up in La Habra, which is sort of North Orange County area.
Yeah, okay.
And it's inconveniently far from all the freeways, which is kind of good, kind of bad. So, yeah, I had a band called Eulogy. That I would think I started that when I was like 13 or 14 with my buddies, and we were together a while and had a lot of actual local success and played with some cool bands, including The Police and Van Halen and, you know, all sorts of stuff. And things evolved, you know, some of those people ended up as people I still know or work with or whatever. And so, yeah, so I'm sure some people will probably know me. I was like, hey, I remember you at that party, blah, 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 you know.
And this had to have been, what, late 70s, early 80s? When was this for
you?
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, okay. And then the next band that you ended up with, we just mentioned the Living Daylights. So how old were you by this point? You were barely into high school with Eulogy.
Yeah, it's funny, evolution, you know. It's like I always figured the music business would be the least stable thing in the world, but I just, you know, was very pig-headed about it, just wouldn't give it up, so I just kept doing it, and somehow here I am still doing it, you know.
Yeah.
But I've played in a lot of bands. You know, I was in a band called Animal Logic with Stuart Copeland,
right.
The drummer for The Police, and Stanley Clark, who's, you know, a very famous bass player in that world. And that was a really interesting band. And I was in a band called Edna Swap, and we toured around the country. I had like four major records out.
That was the one with Torn.
A song called Torn that Natalie Imbruglia had a hit with, but the song was written by the band. And that band lasted about 5 years. And that was trippy. You know, I learned a lot touring around in the snow and all that crazy stuff. And so now it's definitely, I can appreciate the sort of touring situation we do now. We just got back from New Zealand and Australia and, you know, played all over the place.
That's we, the Rusty Anderson Afternoon, or we,
Paul? We, with this, I'm kind of like, my life is very amorphous. It goes from one thing to the other.
Oh, gotcha.
But
cool.
Yeah, that was with Paul McCartney.
Okay.
Yeah, because we've done all sorts of crazy things with him, you know, like Super Bowl or the Rome Coliseum or whatever. And then, you know, I've done some touring with my group too. Like we've gone to Iceland and Europe and around the States and stuff. Although I tend to, especially these days, limit my shows, doing my solo shows, because, you know, there's so much other stuff going on and touring and stuff that I try to keep them mostly local. It makes it much easier on me, especially with a daughter and all that.
Yeah. Are you still living in Orange County, L.A., this area?
I'm living in L.A., yeah.
Okay, okay.
Well, the apple just doesn't fall far from the tree, apparently.
No, it seems not. So let's go back just a hair with the Living Daylights. You suggested during one of our earlier messages, you suggested Colleen, but I want to hear a little bit about Nilak, or I should say Nilak. Care to explain exactly what I'm asking here? Explain that to the folks that don't know this. I'll probably have it playing in the background, but still.
Okay. Well, yeah, we basically wanted to put out a 12-inch record with one tune on it, which was something that people did. It was sort of a budget thing, right? Mm-hmm. And instead of re-recording a whole new song, we just put the song on the other side backwards, Nilak, instead of Colleen. And there was some DJs that actually would play that, and I got a kick out of it, you know, because it was just really a very last-minute low-budge thing to do. But, you know, like a lot of songs when you play them backwards, they're very intriguing, and this one was certainly that way.
Yes. No hidden lyrics coming through that I recall, but I could see this one making it to Dr. Demento, who I just actually interviewed 2 weeks ago.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I haven't heard his name in years. It's great.
Oh, yeah. He's still doing it. He's off the FM, but he's still got the Dr. Demento show on internet radio. And John Caffiero from Osaka Pop Star, he produced this last album with Demento, and it's presented as a 2-hour, 2-disc Dr. Demento show. It's killer.
Oh, I can imagine, yeah.
You mentioned Edna Swap a little bit ago, and just going back to that, only to explain the name, please. Edna Swap?
Edna Swap, yeah. It was something that when Ann, the singer, announced that she really wanted to call the band Edna Swap, I really didn't want to do it. I'm like, no way, you can't call it Edna. But basically, it stuck, and what it was is a dream that she had. I don't remember the contents of the dream, but that's what it was based on. And so I think that maybe she figured that her higher dream state self should come through and make the decision for everybody. So.
Okay. Now, if you wouldn't mind going into why Edna Swap disbanded, unless this is a contentious issue, and then I really don't want to go into it. But,
it was a sort of a slightly contentious band. There was like a five-headed monster, a lot of strong personalities, you know.
Oh.
But, it made for an interesting band, for sure. Paul Bushnell played bass. He's a very good friend of mine. He's played with all sorts of stuff. We did Elton John together, and I think he's playing with Tim McGraw these days.
Were you with him with John Jorgensen by chance then?
No,
John,
at that point, when we did the Elton thing, it was me and guitar. And Paul and Matt Chamberlain on drums.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and Bernie Taupin had just come back to the fold. So he would, it was amazing. He would have like all these sets of lyrics, you know, typed out, and then he'd hand the sheet to Elton, and he'd sit there and write the song in like 15 minutes. And then I'd like sit next to him on the piano and work out the chords, and then we'd just go. And it was really an organic, cool process. It was amazing to watch.
Now, Rusty, I didn't know of this part of you. When were you working with Elton? When was that?
It was sort of brief. We did a record together called Songs from the West Coast, which is a really great record, actually.
Hmm. And you got to see, I say got to see, but a lot of Elton John's biggest hits were the ones that were co-written with Bernie Taupin.
Absolutely. What a great team.
Yes, and they were apart for a while, and I'd have to say that you didn't see Elton's name as often, but this point when they came back together, you said that he had just come back into the fold at that point.
Yes, exactly. I think it was like 2000-ish, 2001, something like that.
What's, say, one of the songs that you witnessed, as you said, Bernie?
This Train Don't Stop Here Anymore? Yeah, it's a great song. I mean, there's a bunch of really good songs on there. But that one in particular, that was cool.
And that's one that you actually saw Bernie hand over the lyrics and Elton sort of noodled around, and then you did and came
back. Yeah, and then we tracked the song, and, you know, like all the songs, it was about a 2-week process, I think. And it was really cool just getting to be in that world and hang, and, you know, very sweet guy, good people.
That's fantastic. Wow. In my interviews with old doo-wop artists, some of them knew Reginald Dwight as just the session piano player way back when, before he became Elton John. We've been primarily hearing music from the Rusty Anderson Afternoon, though this last one from Elton John with Rusty Anderson. More with Rusty in just a little over a minute, including the start of his association with Paul McCartney. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org, I'm David Fleming. Back now to music and conversation with Rusty Anderson, his band, the Rusty Anderson Afternoon. Now beyond his own band, Rusty's been touring with the Paul McCartney Band since 2001. I don't care who a person is, who a person has worked with, you don't generally expect a call from Paul McCartney. Did you actually get the call? This is when I want to go into the beginning of your relationship with Paul McCartney, and I think, did it actually start with you were recording maybe a song for one of his studio albums? How did all this start for you?
A producer friend of mine that I work with a lot, we were talking on the phone. He said, oh, by the way, looks like I'm doing the next Paul McCartney record. I'm like, wow, that's fantastic.
Cool.
Because I liked his work, as David Kahn, his producer, and I loved his work, and we'd worked together a lot, and, you know, obviously Paul, you know, everybody loves Paul, and I thought, well, this would be a good combination, make some good music, so, and he goes, oh, by the way, I think I might need a guitar player, I'm like, great, and so he brought Abe and I in, we did that record, Abe the drummer, was an amazing drummer, and it just sort of was a nice chemistry, and it just kept going from there, and then I think that band started touring in 2002, and and it's been the same ever since. And so that's like crazy amount of time. And it's sort of like in rock and roll years, it's like being married for, you know, 100 years or something, you know?
Yes.
So that's a nice thing to realize that, you know, it's had that good chemistry and continues to feel good. You know?
Oh, most certainly. Most certainly. And so when this went in, I guess this was 2001, I guess, what was the point, say, between recording for the album and then you ended up going on tour with him? Was it because he was touring that disc?
Yes.
Okay.
Although we did a gig right after 9/11. Mm. It was for the Concert for New York, and it was this crazy gig. You know, it was like David Bowie and the Stones, and, you know, everybody was there. I remember Drew Barrymore, I think she was afraid to fly because, you know, at that point, everyone was flipped out over the fact that your airplane could be a, you know, a bomb or whatever.
Yes.
So, you know, and I remember flying to New York going, wow, it's like cricket, cricket, nobody in here, you know. So it was really interesting times if you can put your headset around there. And so we did that show. And after, you know, meeting all these people that I'd met and just feeling completely overwhelmed by the celebrity thing. And then I thought, well, at least we'll go on stage and we'll have all the colored lights and everything will be, you know, that sort of thing the music does and the lighting, and it pulls you together. And then Jim Carrey announced us. We go on stage and the whole thing was a white classroom. You know, it was like this Madison Square Gardens had been reduced to this. Every light in there was these white lights, and it was all about the firefighters who were in the front, you know. And so it was very sort of sobering in a way. But then we rocked it and went into it. And afterwards, I sort of felt like, you know, I can do anything now.
Yeah.
Nothing I will be afraid of.
Oh, yeah. Certainly. With all those lights, were you able to see the firefighters, at least those first couple of rows?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was the thing. It's like all of a sudden it was all about the audience, and it was this big, awesome communal thing, really. It was a very different experience. But that was our first real show with the band. And 2002, we started touring and haven't looked back.
So now let's look at Undressing Underwater, because I read you sort of recorded it piece by piece between and during touring with McCartney.
This is true. Okay. And in fact, I asked Paul, I said, hey, man, I'm doing this record and I would love if you would play on a song. And he goes, great, okay. And so
simple as that, really.
We went down to the studio. I'm like, oh, my God, we have 3 days to do this. So I booked it very quickly and got the whole McCartney band in there. And Paul came in a little bit after everybody else, and he was playing bass, and I was showing him the song. And, you know, it was so cute. He would make a mistake, and he'd go, shoot, you know, just cursing himself, just like everybody else does, like I've done a million times, you know. And it was really endearing. And so we put it together, and then he called me back the next day, and he said, yeah, that was really cool, you know, nice tune, and it was really fun. And I had an idea for the rescue bit. Mm. We had this part, he calls it the rescue bit, because it was a section that really I'm like, I don't know what to do here. I don't know if this should be lyrics or instrumental or what kind of thing it is. And he goes, what if you put something sort of, you know, different in there, like, you know, maybe a trumpet or a flute or an oboe or something unexpected there. So we did that, and we put in a flugelhorn, actually, and Proben, who plays with Brian Wilson.
Oh, wow,
he's a great player. He came in and played the part. And yeah, so it was a real nice combo of ideas that sort of put that together. And Paul came in, and he played bass, he sang background vocals, and he played even a little guitar, and really fun process.
The rescue bit, where does that appear on the album?
It's sort of like after the second chorus. It launches into this part with this flugelhorn on it. You can identify it pretty quickly. Yeah.
Okay.
More than you ever could.
That's music from the Rusty Anderson Afternoon, in conversation with Rusty Anderson. More at rustyanderson.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Online at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. There was another one. Did Stuart Copeland come in for Catbox Beach?
Yes, exactly. Like I said, we were in a band together, and we'd done different things together. I'd played on some of his soundtrack stuff also after the band broke up. And so he came in and played drums on the thing, and Brian Ray played bass, you know, with the McCartney band, and we tracked it, and it was really a kick. And then the middle section, I thought, because the song had a weird evolution. It started off as like this sort of a classical Bach-inspired piece, and I thought, after putting it to like a rock beat, I thought, wow, this sounds suspiciously like surf music. So then it sort of turned into the surf song, and then Stuart was playing. I'm like, well, if he's going to play on it, maybe we should throw in some reggae. So we put reggae in the middle section. That's how that evolved, because I thought it would be such a waste not to have Stuart doing some of the signature bits. So that's what that song's about. A lot of fun recording, and he's a wonderful guy. We're good friends. We go bike riding and stuff, and you know.
I have to say that I'm a jazz nut, and particularly with fusion. And so I've been fortunate to interview Stanley Clarke a couple of times. And when I was listening to Animal Logic, I'm sorry, but it was more like I was listening to Stanley Clarke, and there was a drummer and another guy, you know, kind of thing. So with no offense, but I'm going to have to go back now and listen with a different ear, because now I'm speaking with the guitarist from this group. It was a fusion.
Yeah, I think I played on the second record that came out, it was a little of a blur. My favorite stuff actually was Animal Logic. Unfortunately, it was these sound checks. Like, you'd be traveling around an airplane or van or whatever, and you'd get to the show, and then you'd sit up and just start jamming, and these jams were incredible.
Yeah.
They were just unbelievable, and none of it, to my knowledge, was recorded or used for anything.
Oh.
But yeah, it was a cool band in the respect. Just the musicality of it was pretty astounding. 1990, maybe?
And how did that happen? Were you and Stuart already friends at that point?
No, actually, maybe they knew of me. I played on some Bangles records.
Oh, that's
like
right.
Matic Monday, Walk Like an Egyptian record, a bunch of stuff on there. And then I think through the IRS chain, the Animal Logic was on IRS, so they asked me to come down and play with the band and sit in, and then it just started touring and recording and whatever.
Gotcha. Okay, cool.
Born on Earth is on a record called, funnily enough, Born on Earth. It's basically an environmental cry, you know. And that was an interesting evolution, too, in the respect that I had this section that I wrote inspired by, like, a classical bit, like Wagner, Switched on Bach or something.
Okay.
And then I had this heavy rockin' riff, and I sort of stuck the two together when I realized they were in the same tempo and the keys could work and stuff. And it's one of my favorite things when you can do that, of like linking musical things you would not necessarily connect, but they still connect, they work together, you know, and they make a joint statement.
That one really caught me.
Yeah.
It made me think of, I have to say, reminded me a little bit of Rainbow, in the sense that Ritchie Blackmore would do some of those, some classical pieces or even a medieval sounding something or other before launching back into the rock end of it. So that was, I guess,
could see that.
Yeah.
I could see that.
Yeah. What would be some kind of nice behind the scenes thing that you could tell on Paul and Paul would not mind about it?
Well, I mean, yeah, there's been so many fun times, and I mean, you know, hanging out in the plane together or whatever. Although there was one crazy moment where we had started a tour, and I remember we were rehearsing in Miami, and then we started playing in Florida on the first shows, and Paul insisted on, like, I really want to have this piano because he plays piano, he plays bass, it went over. I want to have it come out of the center of the stage, you know, and then I can play in the center of the stage and it go away and you know, like, okay, great. So the guys made the whole contraption and everything. And so we're doing like the second or third show, and then he's talking to the audience, he's holding his bass, and he's just about to introduce me, actually. And he walks backwards, forgetting that there's this giant hole in the stage where the piano is coming out. And he falls backwards, and he just falls right on top of the piano. And it's a long way down. It's like, because it's the bottom. It's like he must have fallen like 8 feet or something. I don't know, some crazy amount, because it's on top of the stage. And then his bass just goes, you know, and falls. And I'm like, oh, my God, is he alive? What's going on? And I have like this perfect vantage point because I'm right next to him. So I'm looking down there, and then the piano riser starts coming up, and it starts rising up, and then he sort of like organizes himself and gets back on the piano bench and doesn't really miss a beat, you know, and then just launches into the next song. And I was like, man, and he wasn't even sore the next day. I was just astounded. Like, he fell perfectly, you know what I mean? It's like the traffic accident where you don't know what's coming, and then you don't get hurt.
This is the equivalent of going through the windshield and landing on your feet and going into Maybe I'm Amazed.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, it was one of those. So that was an interesting moment.
Wow.
But anything can happen.
Again, more at rustyanderson.com. You and your background, and you can find some earlier recordings and some other stuff when you go to the store. It's a cool looking website to see how it's arranged, and people just have to go there to see what I'm talking about. But it starts with Enter at Your Own Risk. It goes from there.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's so funny because they have all those forum websites that are like,
yes,
you know, little boxes and everything is like, you know, special free sample, da 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 da, you know.
Yep.
And I just didn't want that vibe, you know. To keep it a little more kind of something interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, a little bit between Alice Cooper and Ronnie James Dio. I don't know. They're just the Enter at Your Own Risk. You know, that draws you in immediately. So that's cool.
Yeah, I figured if it says don't sit here or don't kick me here or don't smoke this, you know, people will always do it.
Yep.
There was a company called Death Cigarettes for a while, and it said, don't smoke Death Cigarettes.
Those were black with a skull and crossbones on
right.
them.
I think they figured they would go for the, you know, human nature.
Just be honest.
Yeah, or don't tell people not to do something, so they would do it.
Right, right.
That was my thinking, reverse psychology.
Fantastic. You know what? The only one we didn't touch on was Wishful Thinking Road.
This one's on the newest record, which is called RAA. And Wishful Thinking Road, yeah, it's sort of about lost friendship and stuff. And it started as a jam, and Eric and Todd and I sort of jammed the riff together, sort of the main riff of the song. It's got this cool 6/8 sort of jazzy, bluesy thing. Mm. And then it evolved from there. Yeah, it's cool. It's actually a nice live song because it gives us a chance to sort of open up and extend it a bit.
Nice. This is on RAA. It's Rusty Anderson Afternoon. Again, you said it came from a jam. You guys were just kind of goofing around between takes, or somebody,
we came in. We got together actually at Eric's studio and just started jamming a few things, and that was one of them. And it sort of, when I listened back to the recording, I thought, oh yeah, this is something. This really is inspiring me. And then Todd and I got together and started working on the melodies and the lyrics, and it evolved from there, and I was really happy with the way it came out.
It's music from the Rusty Anderson Afternoon and conversation with Rusty Anderson. We've heard several tracks from the latest disc from the Rusty Anderson Afternoon, simply called RAA. This and more once again at rustyanderson.com. And that's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Rusty Anderson. And with the man who shot Liberty Valance coming to Riverside soon, thanks to Mia Mercado and Sean Warner. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Benjamin Perper, Isel Quapio, Jessica Greenwell, and KVCR General Manager Keith Bergfeld. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts. Behind us now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVCR's programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year at kvcrnews.org. And thanks again.